Monday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. Lots of big games to get to, none of which ended up being close, sadly, but also are games that I think some fan bases are going to be thinking about for a long time. Also got some news to get to as well, so let's get right to it. And unfortunately, one of those fan bases that's going to be thinking about things for a while is the Utah Jazz.
Yeah, I mean, Utah had a game against a Mavericks team that has been, you know, playing well, but still dealing with a lot of injuries. And if they won this game, they were going to be in control of their own destiny. And now that is not true.
Yeah, and really, they're in big trouble because Houston just creamed Minnesota tonight in a somewhat odd game for Minnesota, who'd been playing really well to not show up. Maybe it was, I didn't get to see that much of that game. I was going to watch it, but with it being such a blowout, I decided not really to bother with watching too much of it. Maybe Minnesota just kind of fell apart on their first game home after a West Coast road trip. That'll happen sometimes. But now all Houston has to do is beat Sacramento at home on Wednesday. They have the tiebreaker due to it. Is it a superior conference record?
Yeah, it's conference record because they're not in the same division.
And Sacramento, James Hamm reporting out of Sacramento that, as has been the case lately, Sacramento will be resting their guys, their main guys, on the road to finish up here. They've already played their last game at Sleep Train Nay Arco Arena, and they want to try to get a better draft pick, avoid this slight chance of giving up their pick, top 10 protected, to the Bulls, increase the chance that they will swap it to the Sixers instead. Just kidding, Kings fans. But anyway, it's not looking great for the Jazz because all Houston has to do is win. It doesn't matter whether the Jazz win on the road in L.A. on Wednesday.
And that's actually also exacerbated by the real possibility they're playing right now that Sacramento wins this game. And if they win tonight and their goal is to have a better draft pick, then the pressure to lose on Wednesday gets even more strenuous.
The overwhelming pressure to lose. Well, we know the pressure to win hasn't really worked out that well for the Kings, but maybe the pressure to lose can finally make them win some games.
If they win tonight, they'll be 6 of their last 10.
That's remarkable. So let's get to the game itself, though. Derek Favors did not start. He came in with about 5 minutes gone by in the first, was definitely limping around. Deron Williams, who is still struggling with a sports hernia that is not healed, he played against the Clippers yesterday and did okay, and then he was just unbelievable in this game, was booed every time that he touched the ball, and it almost seemed like that kind of galvanized him into a great performance, maybe kind of backfired for the Utah fans because he is often criticized for being too passive, and he was not in this game.
He wasn't, and so he had 23 points, a 9-16 shooting, and 3-3 from the line. Those free throws actually ended up being pretty big. From what I remember, 2 of the 3 were late in that game to pretty much ice it, and he just played well. You know, he made decent decisions. He was being aggressive, drawing fouls. I thought he did a really nice job.
16 points in the second quarter for D-Will, had the mid-range jumper working in large part, and he was fantastic. And of course, the other guy who was fantastic was Dirk Nowitzki. 11 rebounds, which were actually pretty key rebounds. You thought the Jazz might beat up the less athletic Mavs on the glass, and yet they only managed 6 offensive rebounds. And then Dirk also, of course, had 22 points. He was plus 14 on the night, only 14 shooting possessions. So he himself was incredibly efficient. And then also Utah just had no answer for him in pick and roll. They tried switching it. Dirk scored over Shelvin Mack at the elbow. They tried blitzing it. Dirk hit threes. He was 4 out of 7 on threes. They tried bringing a defender over from the weak side. They threw it to the weak side. Wes Matthews, Deron Williams hit some threes. It was just, they couldn't stop him. And the score was only 99-92. It was a very low possession game. Utah just had no answer for the Mavs all night.
Yeah, and you brought up the rebounding, which, of course, Dirk's excellence is important, but I was floored, and part of this is, we'll talk about Rudy, I'm sure, very soon, is that Rudy was out, but Dallas out-rebounded Utah both on the offensive glass and overall, which is not something I would have expected with these two teams.
Yeah, that was not good. Yeah, 10 offensive rebounds to a Dallas team that is certainly not known for that, although a bunch of those were Zaza Pachulia on one possession. He had like 3 offensive rebounds as he just like kept getting blocked on one possession. But nonetheless, and Wes Matthews also was fantastic. 4 out of 10 on threes. He hit 2 absolute killer threes in the third quarter, contested, fading away to his right with the shot clock winding down. And on the other hand, I mean, Dallas wasn't amazing on threes. They're 11 out of 32, but they hit some timely ones. And Utah, after being on fire from three in the first half, including Joe Ingles, was just way off in the second half, and they finished 9 out of 33 despite getting a ton of wide open looks.
Yeah, it was one of those games where, you know, you could see it. Actually, part of it reminded me of the Warriors in the first quarter against the Spurs, where the Jazz were getting good looks, they just weren't going in.
It was way worse than that. I mean, Gordon Hayward alone in the third quarter, 0-5 on threes, four of them absolutely wide open, three of them corner threes. He finished 1 of 9 on threes, and he was actually, that made him 10 of 11 on twos. he was actually finished up 11 of 20. He's the only Jazz man. I guess Shelvin Mack also was 8 out of 14, and the Jazz offense wasn't that bad. If they had just hit a few more threes, they would have been right in this game. And Hood, unfortunately, was 1 for 11, 1 of 7 on threes. That really hurt as well. Mack didn't really hit his threes either. The only one who had it working from there was Joe Ingles. So Favors was pretty hobbled. And then Rudy Gobert sprained his ankle after trying to contest a Zaza Pachulia shot, landed on Zaza's foot, ankle bone went down to the floor, and that was, you figured that was the end of the night for him. I'm sure he's a huge competitor. He would have loved to have come back, but just wasn't an option for him with how badly he was hurt. And that killed the Jazz as well.
Yeah, there was a hope that Jeff Withey would be able to kind of stem that tide, as he did a little bit. You know, he deserves credit for keeping them a little bit afloat.
Yeah, other than the fact that he got just stuffed at the rim by Dirk on one play, which was pretty
then hopeless. Hope was dead.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think what I kept on struggling with during this game is that it's kind of this weird curse of the team that got really, that was encouragingly out of the playoffs the year before. Phoenix was that 2 years ago. They didn't make it in. And now it looks, not to prematurely eulogize the Jazz, but it looks largely because of bad luck.
I think it's about time. I mean, you have to say Houston is probably 80% favorites on.
And it's crazy because Utah's going to be that team again. So we'll see if that, see if it continues for a third consecutive year.
Yeah. Maybe a little early to eulogize them in a more macro sense. And worth noting, too, Dallas had some heroic efforts in this game. I mean, Wes Matthews coming off a torn Achilles, I think he led them in minutes this year, I want to say. Dallas went 9-3 after Chandler Parsons went down for the year. What a performance that was. Rick Carlisle decided to slow the pace down for them about 7 or 8 games ago. And after that, the only game that they lost was on the road to the Clippers. It was after that Golden State game. They went on to play in Denver, slowed it down, and that really helped their defense to a fair degree. And D. Will played hurt, obviously. J.J. Barea missed last game with a groin strain. He was 2 out of 11, but he toughed out 27 minutes. They got good minutes out of Ray Felton. I thought David Lee really, Salah Mejri was good. I thought David Lee was really the only Mav that you can look at other than Barea, who didn't play that well in this game. They were just fantastic. They hit their shots. And it all started, of course, with Dirk and what he was able to do in his 32 minutes.
Dallas deserves a ton of credit, just overall, but specifically in this game, for just bringing it. It was completely justifiable, considering everything that happened, for them to just kind of pull it in a little bit. And I was surprised that the Jazz announcers kept talking about how this is like Dirk's last playoff run. I don't think this is his last year, personally. But it's still an...
No, he has $8 million waiting. He would be the first person I can think of to give up that much money.
Besides,
he's still good. Why would he? Well, yeah, but that wasn't like a guaranteed contract that was already signed that he just... I'm talking about like people who have guaranteed money remaining and then just retire.
I agree with you. I was just being cool.
You know.
But yeah, but anyway, yeah. But like Dallas, you know, they could have packed it in a little bit, but they have a lot of guys with pride, and they also have a lot of guys who are going to be upcoming free agents, which of course does matter as well. And Wes Matthews, who just competes like a madman all the time, and Rick Carlisle's done a great job, and they're making the playoffs.
Yeah, I was disappointed a little bit in Utah's defensive effort in this game, because they defended Golden State so well in both games in Utah. Their communication was outstanding. They didn't let Steph Curry really get loose at all in those games, but they just kept screwing up the communication time and again on those plays with Dirk, and one of the differences that makes a team like Golden State so special, and maybe watching them all the time makes me have my standards too high, but for example, there's a play where, you know, Dirk was just kind of posting up on Mack after a switch, but everything was totally stagnant, and Rudy Gobert was guarding Zaza Pachulia, basically standing right next to him, and he should have just told Mack, hey, get out, you get Zaza, who's not really a post threat. I got Dirk. And just like that level of communication is just something that, at least in this game, the they didn't have. Usually they do a pretty good job. They're one of the better defensive teams, especially since Derek Favors returned to the lineup. But I thought just they were bad in that way, and they also just missed so many threes, so many open shots, especially in the second half. And, you know, while I hate to sort of follow the conventional wisdom, it did look like Utah, in front of what was it, started off as a raucous home crowd, just didn't have quite the poise needed as the league's youngest team, Dallas, the league's second oldest team. Their experience really seemed to come through tonight.
It also sets up, assuming Memphis loses to the Clippers tomorrow, which of course is a possibility that, you know, could be affected. San Antonio is set up for one of the all-time perverse incentive situations, because if they lose to Dallas, in all likelihood, then they get Memphis in the first round, which I presume they would rather face.
Okay, so why is that?
So basically, Portland is functionally, they're overwhelmingly in the five seed just by virtue of being a win ahead, and they have an easy win. Dallas and Memphis, if they end up tied at whatever win total, Dallas wins that by virtue of beating Memphis three times out of four. So that means theoretically, if they're the 6 and 7, that means Dallas gets the 6 and then it wouldn't face Oklahoma City, and Memphis gets the 7. And I believe, I haven't done it all the way, but from what I know, that in the case of a three-team tiebreaker, either in terms of, I think Dallas passes Portland, but Memphis still gets the 7. So they don't have complete control, because Memphis plays another game. They play the Clippers tomorrow, but in all likelihood, San Antonio can massage that result.
Yeah, and Portland plays at home against Denver. You'd expect that they are significant favorites to win that game. Memphis almost certainly will lose their last two at the Clippers at Golden State, unless the Clippers also decide to kind of mess with things a little bit too. And Dallas only has one more game left. So we'll see what happens on Tuesday. Tomorrow night, the Clippers will also have a little bit of a say in this, although it doesn't really matter for them. They're probably going to get Portland regardless, because Portland is a good favorite to beat Denver.
And has the tiebreaker one-on-one over Memphis.
Couple other notes on this one. An example of how the Jazz really kind of were not ready for the moment in this one. The record scratch of the year may have occurred. I think the Jazz got an offensive rebound. They kicked it out to Trey Lyles, wide open for three on the wing. He then kicked it up top to Joe Ingles, who was not open, but pump faked ingeniously into being wide open, and then inexplicably threw it back to Lyles, who was also wide open, and decided to drive into a turnover instead.
We didn't communicate this at all, but as soon as you said the record scratch of the year, I knew exactly what play you were talking about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was really bad. And the other key play really was that it was a four-point game at halftime. Dallas just started killing Utah with Dirk. Utah was missing these wide-open threes. They were down, I think, by 12, and then they stormed back and were within 66-64. I think they could have tied it and missed a three. Hayward missed a wide-open three from the left wing that could have given them the lead and would have just absolutely taken the roof off the place, the announcers were saying. And then Dallas came down on the other side. Wes Matthews, with the shot clock running down, hit one of those crazy threes, and Dallas was up 5 and never really got threatened again. Now, I'm always kind of loath to say, like, oh, maybe things would have changed if they made that one shot in what ended up being a game that wasn't really close at the end. But, you know, sometimes you never know, like, what the butterfly effect of one or two shots could be sometimes.
Yeah, it certainly would have given them a substantially better chance. Whether that would have made the difference, we don't know. But it certainly would have helped, especially with that crowd. I think that was really what took the wind out of their sails until the Chick-fil-A in the last minute.
Before we go on, Danny, we have a new sponsor, our friends at Vistaprint, who are offering 500 business cards for just $9.99 using our familiar cap space code. Vistaprint is fantastic for small business owners. I am, in fact, a small business owner. That is what this podcast is. And when I first was working as a lawyer, I realized that I needed some separate business cards. I couldn't have people emailing me about the NBA at my work email address. And Vistaprint provides that service really well. They also allow you to upload your logo and create mugs, pens, t-shirts, whatever you want to do for your small business. Vistaprint is the best way to do it. Much, much cheaper than going to someone locally, because they have a much greater economy of scale than your local print shop does. You can get banners, apparel, invitations, flyers, and of course those business cards that you can get 500 of for just $9.99. Vistaprint guarantees you'll absolutely love your products, and if they don't, they will make it right. They have fantastic customer service. They also offer custom design services if you don't want to design your own product for your business. So why wait? Get those 500 business cards starting at just $9.99 using the CapSpace code. That's Vistaprint.com using the CapSpace code. All right, let's move on to Boston and Charlotte. The NBA is a weird league. Charlotte lost to John Wall-less Washington on the road yesterday. They're on the second game of a back-to-back, also playing on the road. Boston was not on the second game of a back-to-back, and Charlotte crushed Boston.
Yeah, that's kind of what happens when you get a 31-3 run at any point in a game.
It was hilarious because Boston was actually ahead, I think, by 8 or something. And, you know, Kaminsky and Hawes had not been playing well. I was like, oh, there went, you know, Charlotte's defense. And then Charlotte kind of came back. All right, now they tied it. I wrote down in my notes, like, 11-0 run. Then they scored a few more points. I wrote down in my notes, like, 18-2 run. And finally, it was a 31-3 run. I had to change my notes like 3 times because it just kept going on. I figured like it had to be over at some point. I mean, that was just ridiculous. I thought my biggest takeaway from this game was that Boston, other than just that short stretch against the Hawes-Kaminsky combination, absolutely could not score against the Charlotte defense, even with Al Jefferson starting for Cody Zeller, who was out with an injured sternum.
And doesn't that tie in reasonably well with their massive struggles against the Hawks, too, another team that kind of can swarm and protect the rim?
When did the Celtics have massive struggles against the Hawks?
Haven't the Hawks basically beaten them almost every time this year, including...
Yeah, they scored like .111 on them the other night, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
It wasn't
an offensive failing. I think I was remembering maybe it was their second game of the year against them that the Hawks just played them really well.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know. This kind of makes you worry about Boston's ability to score in the playoffs. They certainly struggled against Cleveland to do that, especially when Isaiah Thomas doesn't have it working. And I thought one of the key stretches here was in that run was Brad Stevens kind of came back with his starters to quell the run, and Isaiah Thomas had a couple of turnovers, and they ended up getting down by about 15. And Brad Stevens took him out when they hadn't. Now, granted, I know he had some turnovers; he wasn't playing well, but Brad took him out, and then they basically just didn't score the rest of the half. And what would have been maybe a manageable 15-point deficit turned into like 22-23 by the end of the half, and the game was pretty much over. So I thought that was a little bit odd. They also were hurt by foul trouble for Olynyk and Bradley, both of whom had 3 fouls, and actually Bradley got his 4th in the first half. So Stevens was being pretty aggressive with the foul trouble, and, you know, after a while, they just kind of went to their subs. You know, R.J. Hunter played the whole fourth quarter and actually had 11 points, was +8. But yeah, I mean, Stevens took out Thomas and went to Terry Rozier, and then he put in Tyler Zeller, who's been getting DMPs instead of one of the other centers. And, you know, I felt like that kind of, granted, it's not like the starters were playing well, but it sort of exacerbated the problem. Another guy who exacerbated the problems for the Celtics was Jeremy Lin.
Yeah, I mean, Jeremy Lin, we've seen him have some big games against talented opponents this year. He was gigantic in that game against the Spurs in that massive comeback. And tonight, 25 points, 7 of 14 from the field. And also, I think, not equally importantly, but 7 rebounds is jaw-dropping for a guy with his role.
5 steals. He was huge in that run as well. And a big part of how Charlotte was able to stop Boston was that they were just helping off the guys who couldn't shoot. Whoever was guarding Evan Turner was just camping out in the lane. If it was Marcus Smart, that guy was camping out in the lane. At one point, they had Rozier, Smart, and Evan Turner all on the floor together as their perimeter guys. And so the Celtics would drive in the lane where they're kind of used to having a little bit more space. And, you know, especially when they had Amir Johnson in there, too, they just weren't guarding those guys. And Johnson kind of flubbed a couple of finishes inside as well. So it really was kind of the blueprint of how to beat the Celtics when they don't have their shooters in there. And Turner is a guy who, well, you know, a lot of Celtics fans have kind of been talking about him for sixth man, and he has played well by what his standards are, but his complete inability to hit a 3 is really damaging at times on offense. And this is one of those times, and that's how Lin was able to get all these steals, was by helping off of guys that you didn't need to guard on the perimeter.
Did you hear anything about if something's wrong with Jeremy Lamb? Because not only did he get a DNP in this game, but he also only played a little over two minutes against Washington.
You know, I haven't seen an official report of that, although someone tweeted that at me. Troy Daniels has played more than him. Daniels shot well, but also was -17 in this game. He's not a better player than Jeremy Lamb. I would really question, you know, maybe Lamb hasn't been playing well the last couple of weeks, but certainly over the course of the year, Lamb has been a better player. I'd wonder whether that's a great idea to be playing Daniels over him. Let's see, what else did I take away? Oh, yeah, Al Jefferson destroyed the Celtics in the post. He was 8 out of 11 from the field with his customary zero free throw attempts. But Jared Sullinger couldn't guard him. You really need a guy who has a ton of length to deal with Big Al. Young guys also can kind of get beat up by his crap. When they went to Zeller, that was another reason I wasn't that happy they went to Zeller, because he wasn't going to stop him either. And maybe Amir Johnson would be the only guy who would have a good chance of matching up against Big Al, and even he might be a little too thin for this present incarnation of Big Al. But then, because of the fact that the Celtics weren't really adequately able to space the floor, Big Al, they were not really able to take advantage of him defensively out in space the way that you would have hoped.
Was another weird storyline of this day is that a lot of guys played well against former teams. Darren and Wes in that first game, Al Jefferson this game, Ersan Ilyasova dropped 22 on the Bucks. I don't know what that was, but sometimes that happens.
Yeah, it's the end of the season can definitely be pretty weird. Another guy we got to talk about is, before we get to some kind of less good news for the Hornets, is Marvin Williams. He's someone who actually, most improved sixth man. There are always a billion guys who you can talk about in those conversations. But Marvin Williams was really bad last year in the first year of his $7 million a year contract for 2 years. They signed him away from Utah. He got into much better shape this year. He's been protecting the rim. His three-point shot has been on. He was 4 out of 8 on threes in this one. And the Hornets were 14 of 32 overall, which is quite sterling. And you don't really think about improvement for a guy that old, but he's been awesome this year. Like, he's been a really, really valuable player. I mean, if you could guarantee me that he would play the same way next year as he's played this year, like, I would absolutely pay him $15 million a year. He's old. He has had some injury problems in the past. So you wouldn't want to do it for too long. But for next year only, I think he could be like a $15 million a year player if he plays the same way he has this year.
Two things. One, I feel sad that you say, oh, he's old and he's more than a year younger than I am. But one thing that I don't think about as much with Marvin is that he upped his free throw rate pretty substantially. He was averaging 1.1 a game to 1.8 and improved his free throw shooting percentage by more than 10% this year. He actually got above what he did 2 years ago.
Yeah, and he had surgery on his Achilles tendon. It wasn't really a torn Achilles, but he basically missed 6 months with it. And, maybe the next year, 2013-14, was his last with the Jazz. He was really kind of struggling, and maybe it's just taken him that long to kind of get back to being athletic. Perhaps there's been some more dedication involved as well there. The other thing we got to talk about, though, is the sprained ankle for Nick Batum. They were up 23 very early on in the third quarter, and he drove through a pass, came down on Amir Johnson's foot. It did not look as bad as the Rudy Gobert one. It was kind of more one of those where he doesn't land like dead on the side of his foot and the foot goes to the floor. It's more kind of he landed with his toe a little bit, too far extended and, rolled over it a little bit. But it doesn't look like one that's that bad. I mean, you never know for sure with sprained ankles. I would imagine he will probably sit out in their last game of the year against Orlando at home. They can probably beat Orlando without him anyway, and hopefully give him a week of rest before the playoffs start. We don't really know how severe it is, but it didn't look that bad, so I'm somewhat optimistic at least.
Yeah, he definitely seemed to be walking with more kind of comfort and control than Rudy, who just went straight off the floor and went straight into the locker room.
Let's pause for a moment to tell you about our sponsor, Indochino Custom Menswear. This is a sponsor that I've really enjoyed having because I'm somewhat of an oddly shaped guy, and I've always had to get off the rack suits. Getting something custom made to measure was too expensive for me, and it never fit me right. I have kind of big shoulders. I'm tall. They just don't work. The pants will be too wide. They say they'll tailor it for you, but it doesn't fit the way something that's made to measure does. Indochino uses 14 unique measurements for you to create a custom suit that fits only you. You can pick your lining, lapels, a personal monogram, whatever you want, really, to customize it, the buttons, just about everything. And it's just a fantastic value because my listeners can get any premium suit for just $3.99, up to 50% off using that familiar CapSpace code. We use that CapSpace code for pretty much all of our sponsors. And if you go to Indochino.com, you also get free shipping. What's more, if it doesn't fit you perfectly the first time around, you can send it back and they will fix it for you. And if it still doesn't work, you can return it. So there's basically no risk whatsoever. To get an awesome premium suit for just $3.99, up to 50% off at Indochino.com using that promo code CAPSPACE. Indochino.com, promo code CAPSPACE, and you can get a suit that is your look, your way. Let's talk a little bit about Cleveland and Atlanta. Cleveland won very comfortably against Atlanta. LeBron James probably has not been getting enough talk on this show, frankly, for how well he's played since the All-Star break, because he's just kind of considered a given. One thing that people were kind of tweeting at us during the game was he's up to 36% on threes, 37% or something, since the All-Star break now after going 3 out of 4 in this game. He shot, I think, 4 out of 5 in that game against the Bulls on Saturday, showing a little bit more confidence. Overall, he was 13 of 16, and he had 34 points on 18 shooting possessions. Just a ridiculous performance. Also 6 assists and 6 rebounds. Atlanta, for all their defensive prowess, really has never been able to stop him in last year's playoffs, and still look to have big problems with him again this year.
Yeah, and Kent Bazemore had a really nice opening stretch to the game, and that helped give Atlanta what was a kind of a shocking early buffer. I think they also blocked 4 shots in like the first 6 minutes. But
yeah, they led 12-2 at one point.
Yeah, and then Cleveland just rolled them over basically from then on.
So what do you think? I mean, do you think that there's some possibility that LeBron might now need to be guarded again from the three-point line? I mean, because that really, it's not even so much of like whether his shots actually go in. It's whether, strategy-wise, you now cannot go under on the pick and roll with him anymore. And I mean, you can also switch it as well, but if he's hitting his three, that big is going to have a lot more trouble guarding him if he feels like he has to guard him out there. So, I mean, that it's not even so much the issue of like, all right, what percentage is he shooting? How many points are they scoring off of those actual shots? It's just whether he has to be respected out there. He obviously did in Miami. By last year's playoffs, he didn't. First half of this year, he didn't. He's shooting a little bit better now. He's been hot lately. What do you make of all that?
I still lean towards thinking that you can at least start by going under him, especially when you consider just that what else you're kind of sacrificing with your offense, with your defense, if you're playing up on him, whatever you're going to do there. So I would go that way, but you have to be ready to change that assumption if he actually starts doing well.
Yeah, maybe that's right. I would still lean towards letting him shoot it. And I'm talking, if in a playoff series, I'm talking about letting him shoot it like over the course of like 2 games. And if he's still killing you, then maybe you adjust. But having to play him normally on the pick and roll, he's such a good passer. He's such good size and vision, such a good finisher at the rim. They're putting so much shooting around him. Like when he was playing with Fry at the five, that's when they kind of made their run to get back into the game. That's going to be a really unstoppable lineup. And I think you just have to kind of pick your poison and go with what's been the trend over the last year and not what's been the trend over the last month or so, even if it's even been that.
Yeah, it certainly seems fair.
The Hawks, Bazemore was 5 of 8 on threes. He had 21 points in the first half. And the rest of the Hawks shot 3 out of 22 from 3. Another big Hawks bugaboo. Al Horford, 0 for 4. Paul Millsap, 0 for 3. Jeff Teague was 1 out of 2. He's been shooting a little better. Dennis Schroeder, another one, 0 for 4. So that this was very similar to me to how things kind of played out in the playoffs last year between these two teams. LeBron absolutely killing them. The Hawks not able to score that well. Cleveland letting them shoot from the outside, but letting their less effective guys perhaps shoot from the outside. And the Hawks not making enough three-pointers. Cleveland switching stuff. The Hawks not being able to attack off of it. It all, I thought, was pretty ugly. Paul Millsap not being able to score one-on-one. He was 3 out of 14 in this game. All of the big reasons why we thought that Cleveland, has a massive matchup advantage against the Hawks came to the fore in this one.
And unfortunately for Atlanta, this loss takes them out of control of their own destiny in terms of the three seed, because now Miami has that. And, they have some tough games left, but Miami now, if they win out, they get the three.
Yeah, and that means, is there any chance that Atlanta could get into the sixth seed?
I'd have to... I don't think it would really be realistic, because they have the tiebreaker on Boston and they have the tiebreaker on Charlotte. So, and they're ahead of them by a win. So no, I don't think so, but I'd have to look at the three ways just to be sure, but I doubt it.
Yeah, that seems pretty
unlikely. Yeah, I think Albert Mudd actually tweeted that they're locked into the four, they're four or better.
Yeah. Okay, well, so that means that they, Miami now controls actually their own destiny for the three seed, although they have a difficult game at Detroit and another one at Boston on a back-to-back the next two nights. Those will be very interesting. Atlanta, I think, playing at Washington against what should be a skeleton crew, you expect them to win that game. Also, this clinched the Hawks under for us, by the way. That was an important loss for our own purposes. It was 49.5, the most they can get to is 49 now. Yeah, I think so. It's looking like probably about a 50-50 chance, I would say, that the Hawks, maybe a little better than that still, to get the 3-seed, because I don't know if Miami... actually, Miami has the tiebreaker over Atlanta.
Right.
So,
head-to-head.
Yeah, but they are a game behind. So if Miami loses one of their last two and Atlanta wins, Atlanta will still be the 3-seed. I imagine they are going to go balls out for that because they want to be in the opposite bracket as the Cavaliers.
A decision question for you. So let's say Miami beats Detroit tomorrow. So that means for Boston that they're not going to host a, you know, they're not going to get the four. Would you rather just slide down to the sixth spot, or because they're playing Miami, so they have a little bit of control over that? Like, if you're Boston, would it be more important to get off the 4-5 than to potentially have more influence over your opponent?
Yes, I would want, if you really you're at, and for Boston especially, I think, I don't know, actually, it's tough. What would be, because this season, while it has been nice, the perception of where they are at as a franchise will be determined by the playoffs. Do you want to make it more likely that you win one series and then lose in the second round? Or do you want to make it less likely you win one series, but more likely that you win two series? What's more important for basically trying to lure in free agents with all the flexibility that they have? That's probably an unknowable question. Frankly, I probably would just try to, whoever I felt better about playing between Atlanta and Miami, I would probably just want to try to win the first series. You know, this is a group that hasn't won a playoff series yet. When you start thinking about getting all the way to the conference finals, they're not going to beat Cleveland anyway. Just try and win one, maybe then give Cleveland a tough series. I guess that's eventually the way I would decide to go. But that's an interesting question. It is not particularly easy. The other interesting battle that we have now, Indiana and Detroit, both 43 and 37. Indiana closes with New York at home at Milwaukee. Detroit with Miami at home at Cleveland. Chris Haynes already reporting that basically nobody important is going to be playing for the Cavs in that game on Wednesday. Part of that is because they clinched home court with this win. But another part might be that they actually want Detroit to win, which, I mean, that's going to affect their seeding quite a bit if Detroit can beat Cleveland on Wednesday in a game that they obviously wouldn't be favored to win.
Wasn't Chris Haynes the one who tweeted out the great quote that Lou said, Sasha Khan will play? It was kind of like that was the note of like, okay, the white flag is definitely out.
Sasha Khan has been recalled from the Canton charge and will play. Yeah, so we'll have a little bit more clarity on some of these, all right, do we tank, do we not tank type of thing. So we only have five games tomorrow. We'll probably talk about the Hoop Summit tomorrow as well then. But yeah, I think that is going to be very interesting to see who Cleveland wants to play, because they will be able to have a significant effect on their destiny. But ultimately, maybe they feel like getting the rest is more important than who they play anyway. So they might just let that one go regardless.
Yeah, and a lot of it, since Detroit doesn't have control over their own destiny, you know, if Indy wins out and they have two very winnable games, it doesn't even really matter.
Where are we at in the lottery now?
Lottery! So assuming that the...
We'll just do the ones that are close.
Yeah.
Maybe we can start with, like, Brooklyn and Phoenix.
Yeah, so Brooklyn losing, getting early smashed and then coming close and then losing means that they're going to have the third most ping pong balls, which then, of course, get passed to the Celtics. Phoenix is actually, right now...
That was actually a double screwing to Phoenix, because Phoenix also has Washington's pick. So if Brooklyn had beaten Washington, Phoenix might have been in position to get a lower pick than Brooklyn, improve their own draft slot, and then also lower the Wizards' draft slot as well by beating them. And so that was doubly bad for Phoenix that Brooklyn was not able to pull out a miracle win after being down 20-0 in Washington.
One that got settled is Minnesota will have the fifth most ping pong balls. New Orleans will have sixth, which is also notable because they play each other in their last game, and now it doesn't matter how that works. They're doing that. Then you have the Knicks at 32 wins, Sacramento, Denver, and Milwaukee at 33, assuming Sacramento pulls this game out. Then Orlando, by virtue of beating Milwaukee today, they're at 35, so they have the 11th pick basically by themselves, and then there's that gulf. And right now, it's Utah because they're the team that would be out of the playoffs, Washington, and Chicago, who actually hurt their, who might have hurt their cause a little bit in terms of picks by winning.
Yeah, Jimmy Butler decided to play point guard, play a ton of minutes, get 10 assists, and they won 121-116 on the road against the Skeleton Crew in New Orleans. And it looks like Sac is going to pull that out. They actually have been like pretty frisky in these road games when Cousins isn't playing. Oh, it looks like Phoenix just hit a three. They're within four. This is amazing, amazing radio here as I'm just looking at the score on the NBA.com page. But Houston is schizophrenic enough that, you know, I don't want to quite write that down in the ledger yet. I mean, they lost at home to the Suns. That's about as bad as losing at home to these Kings would be. But, you know, I mean, we could also see not only tanking in the effect of not playing your best players, but we might even see this one get to
Mark,
like,
Madsen.
Mark Madsen jacking up threes in the last game to keep the top 10 protected pick for Minnesota in the late 2000s level from George Karl. Although George Karl, of course, has no love lost for the organization whatsoever. I mean, if he's going to be fired, you could almost look at it as like, you know, these wins when they've won 6 out of 10 are almost like his final screw you to the organization if he's going to be leaving. So many interesting dynamics. I can't wait to podcast about it. I will be watching that Houston-Sacramento game with rapt attention on Wednesday.
Do you want me to read the 8 players who have played minutes for Sacramento today as reference for the Houston game?
Absolutely. Oh, it's within 2 now, by the way.
Starting 5, Seth Curry, Benjamin McLemore, Rudy Gay, Kosta Koufos, Willie Cauley-Stein.
That's actually not that horrible.
Backups, Justin Anderson, Caron Butler, Quincy Acey.
I mean, that's really no worse than the Suns.
No, it isn't. But the crazy part is they have basically, depending on how you classify guys, they have 2 guards. But they have guys who can play, so that's good. They can roll out lineups like that weird-ass Mavericks lineup.
That was the auto-playing NBA.com highlights you just heard in the background there as I'm trying to find out what's happening in this game. Let's do some news, and we can check back in on that, actually. What do we got first?
So Mark Spears of ESPN reported that Iman Shumpert will miss the final 2 games of the regular season. That was, of course, more notable for today than it will be for the next game because now they're going to sit everybody, but they need Iman Shumpert in their later rounds to be good.
Most notable about this report, I thought, was that he's experiencing soreness and inflammation, and it's not just precautionary. He actually had his knee drained. So this is actually a real thing. Shumpert always seems to be perpetually banged up. While he has been less a part of the team, J.R. Smith has basically been starting all year for them. You know, he hasn't been as good probably even as he was down the stretch last year after hurting his shoulder. They did eventually put him into the starting lineup. He is really their only good defensive player on the wing. If they're going to guard Klay Thompson, they're going to guard Steph Curry, they're going to guard Isaiah Thomas, they're going to need him. I think certainly whoever they're going to play in the finals, then they're going to need him playing at a high level and enough at least so he can knock down some open threes. So that's going to be something to watch. You know, you see guys are playing in the postseason and they don't play well. You know, Paul Millsap was banged up, you know, kind of in similar fashion last year. There's a ton of guys like that where they come back and they're playing, but maybe they don't play that well, and maybe there's a reason for it with that. In New York, this is a couple days old, but I wanted to talk about it a little bit. Kurt Rambis said that Derek Fisher basically gave up on the triangle too quickly, didn't practice it enough, and that just, to me, number one, obviously shows just, again, how invested in the cults of the triangle they are, but also just that Fisher was not really allowed to pick his own assistants. That oftentimes does not work out well. Rambis probably was slightly undermining Fisher in the sense that, one, he was there and Jackson knew that he could go to him as someone he trusted, and number two, you'd have to imagine that he was reporting this very stuff to Phil Jackson with his own personal spin on it. And it also shows that they, you know, are going to still be committed to this. Just, again, not really any of that stuff that I would feel great about it were I a Knicks fan.
And we've talked before about the idea of separating out the triangle and the coaching tree, but I think this story is a good example of how those two things are so intertwined that it might not be useful to separate them out into a difference.
Well, and here's the thing. Fisher was right. He has, like, Carmelo Anthony, who's, you know, he's not terrible for the triangle, but Porzingis certainly is. You know, he's most effective in pick and pops, pick and rolls, like normal NBA actions that kind of just are not there with the triangle. And so, and they started off the season pretty darn well and then just used the excuse to move on from Fisher as soon as it was expedient to get back to this dogmatic approach, which you know, frankly, I think doesn't particularly fit their personnel. So I don't know. I this whole triangle thing, we'll see what happens. There's also a report over the weekend, I forget who it was from, that Phil is kind of desperate to get back to L.A., that Jeannie Buss wants to get rid of Jim Buss, and that Phil could then become the president, you know, after this sterling record that he's had with the Knicks. I actually think people killing him, that other than all this triangle crap and some of the personal stuff, he's actually done pretty well, both in finding some guys, drafting Porzingis, being willing to rebuild, despite the fact that that might have been a bit impolitic with Melo. So I don't think he's actually been so bad, but, you know, it would be hard to say that he would deserve that on anything other than nepotism grounds. But, you know, we've seen a little bit of that in the NBA lately.
And it would be frustrating in a way because the Lakers are such a high-ceiling organization to see that, as opposed to somebody, you know, like maybe in a smaller market that would go to something like that where I wouldn't be.
Well, and guess what? Guess what? You know, I'm glad you said that, because what position is absolutely stacked in 2017 free agency?
Point guard.
Yeah. How many point guards do you know that would love to go play in the triangle offense in a two-guard front where you never get to run pick and roll?
That's a great point.
Jimmy Butler said that he feels like he probably doesn't need off-season knee surgery, or at least he didn't say that, but he said he wants to try and make the Olympic team for USA basketball. That's good for USA basketball, although I don't actually think that he's going to make it. And he also, you know, played in this meaningless game against New Orleans. So maybe he's actually feeling better now. He's played well at times, also had kind of some clunkers. So you wonder maybe if, like, the knee was acting up at times. The Bulls shut down the rest of their guys, Gasol, Rose, Gibson. All of them had been playing in pain, and so they didn't play it at all tonight. Nothing more really to say on that. We'll see whether that actually turns out that he doesn't need the surgery or not. He has looked better lately, but has not looked as explosive. But this Jason Kidd news out of Milwaukee, Gary Wolfel, from the paper in Racine, said that basically he's told that Kidd, who is close friends with Mark Lazarus, who's one of the tri-majority owners there, the rest of the Bucks ownership group doesn't really care for him. They thought he was arrogant. His heart isn't into coaching because he wants to kind of be just an executive full-time. They're annoyed that he took time off for the hip surgery, which, ironically, under Prunty, that was like their most successful stretch of the season, I believe. And he says, some, most importantly, question his coaching acumen and his player personnel decision-making after the night trade when the Bucks were 7 games above 500. They've never made it back to there. The Monroe signing hasn't worked out. And it's also notable that Wolfel basically paints it as Jason Kidd was the one who made all these moves as the executive, even though he does not officially have that title. It's been speculated that he has that. You know, there's also been kind of his ties with his agent, Jeff Schwartz, the drafting of Rashad Vaughn, a Jeff Schwartz client, Michael Carter-Williams trading for him. That hasn't worked out. Jeff Schwartz client. A lot of kind of questionable things that have gone on there in Milwaukee, and it sounds like now there's been some reporting that the ownership group, other than Lazarus, not so happy with Kidd. It'll be interesting to see what happens with him this offseason, a key offseason for the Bucks with a ton of cap space that maybe they shouldn't necessarily even use this year.
Yeah, it's a really tough situation, and it's kind of amazing that Jason Kidd might have thrown in his chips with Michael trading Brandon Knight for Michael Carter-Williams, which was disastrous for a couple different reasons. And I also want to congratulate the Sacramento Kings because they officially beat the Phoenix Suns.
Oh, good for them. Good for them. That is a great way to end the podcast with that sublime NBA basketball. There was actually kind of one other macro point that occurred to me during the Utah game, but I didn't really get a chance to talk about. The Warriors winning 72 games, likely 73. That's a pretty awesome thing for the NBA. And there are a lot, you know, nobody looks, it's not like baseball where it's like, you know, the record for field goal attempts is or field goals made is like the same as the home run records. It's not so much cumulative stats in the NBA as it is averages. So I think those sorts of things, you know, wouldn't be hurt by going to a shorter season. All-time wins records, you know, those would be hurt. You know, most points scored over a career, that sort of thing would be hurt. And I see that argument. But a team going for the all-time wins record, that doesn't outweigh to me the fact that it just seems like every year now, down the end of these games, there are just so many teams, so many great players missing from the playoffs, teams playing hobbled, teams that are just ground down by the season, and just having a season that's the same length with less games. I mean, look at the bottom of the West playoff picture, for example. Like, Dallas, Chandler Parsons is out, Barea is playing hurt, D-Will is playing hurt, you know, barely came back into the game. Utah favors, you know, had to tough it out today. Gobert is out and injured now. Even if they had made it into the playoffs, who knows how things would have been for them. Memphis, obviously, is just a complete joke of a playoff team. I mean, they played hard, but, you know, they just don't have anywhere near the talent that a playoff team should. Portland last year, Kevin Durant was just out last year as well. There are really just so many injuries that seem to kill the playoffs every year. And that, to me, even more than just the whole less quality of play of what we're watching in the regular season, I just want guys to be healthy for the playoffs. And I think that that is something that the league really needs to look at, is just to make guys be as healthy as possible for the playoffs. That's where their bread is buttered as a league.
There may not be a stronger advocate for shortening the season than me in terms of the sports media community, just because I think all these arguments fit together. And also, depending on how drastically you cut it, you can also, from a marketing perspective, do really well with it, just playing more teams just once. But I think it all really does fit together for the quality of the league and for the live gate and for TV audiences to just go to a more patient thing, you know, play the same length of time of the regular season, just less games.
Yeah. The problem, of course, is that people think that less money will be made.
Yeah.
Is that really true? I don't know. Maybe you could probably have the same number of national TV games throughout the course of the year. I don't think that the national TV contract could be the exact same number of games that it is now, because you'd just still have games on those days, and there would actually be less competition from the local market on those days. The value of the national TV contract might, in fact, go up for teams' gates, you know, going from 82 games to 70 or 60 or something. I don't think anyone really knows whether that added scarcity would allow you to charge more and make up for the fact that games are being missed. Certainly, it seems like the feeling among the league is that, you know, that would lead to a reduction in revenue. And I'm not really sure of a way to think of an experiment to determine that. I mean, maybe you could look at the lockout, but then at that point, there were season tickets had already been bought. You know, maybe you could look at the secondary market during the lockout, but then there's also, you have to consider that ill will had kind of been engendered with the fans as well. So I don't know. I mean, can you think of any way that if I'm like, all right, I'm Adam Silver, I want to study this, that you could do it?
There isn't really a clear way. And a point, people talk about the revenue side. I think people focus on the ownership side of a potential revenue drop. I think the player side is more relevant, because I think they're the ones that would actually potentially push harder on it, though I think that's incredibly short-sighted of them. I actually feel that way, that it could be, it's one of these situations where neither side has a strong enough motive to go the right direction, even though it would be prudent for all sides. And also, one of the positive movements for this from a team perspective is, as teams start to have more control over their arena, you can talk about the Warriors when they moved to San Francisco, there are various other examples of that. I think the Bucks will maybe a little bit in Milwaukee, I'm not totally sure. Getting those extra dates, yeah, they might not be as lucrative as an NBA game, especially in a lot of these NBA cities, but you're recouping a lot more of it than you are if you're just leaving the building dormant.
Yeah, and that might be something that would give large market teams even more of an advantage, because, you know, having a concert in New York is much bigger necessarily than having a concert in Oklahoma City or Utah or something. So I don't know. It would be kind of difficult. I mean, maybe you could look at like the Premier League and like, you know, teams that are playing in a European theater and having two games a week as opposed to one, and like what that effect has. I mean, you could get some data maybe to try to get an idea. But the other thing too is that the national TV contract is locked in right now. And so while it might theoretically make the national TV contract more lucrative, they would have to negotiate something there as well. And you know, the whole reason the networks negotiated for such a long contract is because they wanted certainty, and that kind of change might not be so great for it either. A lot of just inertia, why I don't think we will see this happen anytime soon, which is really too bad.
From the revenue standpoint, it also, going to a much shorter season, like I've said, play everyone twice but expand the number of teams a little bit, is that opens up the idea that so many people talk about. I personally don't care for it, but the idea of doing some sort of tournament that exists outside of the regular season schedule, those people who fetishize that, you could do that if you're cutting the number of games for each team by 15, and we know how Americans love single elimination tournaments, and that could even be a separately negotiated TV deal.
Yeah, or you could even have more of a World Club Championship as well, although those leagues don't have enough money to really probably make that interesting, playing against NBA teams in a real, you know, 5-game series or 7-game series or something like that. So I don't know. I do think also you have to consider that everything's going great for everyone right now with how the new TV contract, how much money everyone is making, CBA negotiations are kumbaya right now. And so nobody's going to want to rock the boat. If things weren't doing as well economically and they felt like they had to kind of change things, then maybe you might see like more of an impetus, you know, necessity being the mother of invention. And I think that, you know, maybe if you could prove that everyone makes less money because stars are hurt in the playoffs, you know, if Kevin Durant doesn't play, so the ratings are lower or whatever last year, then maybe you could point to that as well. But, I still don't see it happening anytime soon.
Agreed.
All right, are we done here?
Can I plug some stuff?
We are not done in that case.
So I actually had three things come out today, so I feel like I can plug it. So Warriors Weekly on just kind of the way the playoffs work, it's something you and I have talked about before with the idea of how much better their rotations are going to be in terms of the actual personnel when they're going through. I also wrote a piece on this really weird CBA nuance with Bradley Beal with the expected average player salary, that basically the Wizards, because the salary is slightly below that, he gets a bigger cap hold. They lose, I think it's about $2 million in cap space. And then the third one, again, one of my favorite topics, pick protection. I did a piece for the Sporting News on what we know, what we don't know, and what we won't know for a while.
Yeah, the other big losers with that Jazz loss today, the Nuggets, they now...
Winner.
The Nuggets are winners. Yeah, that's right. They are winners. I'm sorry. Yes, they get Houston's pick if they make the playoffs, right?
Yeah, and they weren't going to get it otherwise because that pick becomes a second if Houston doesn't make the playoffs this year.
All right, thanks so much for listening. Don't forget about the Cat Space code on Indochino Custom Menswear and, of course, our new sponsor, Vistaprint as well. Same thing, Cat Space code there. Other ways to support the program in iTunes, review, or rating. If you're one of the people who says we only talk about the Warriors, maybe you could go back and change your review after you listen today and say that we at least picked one day where we didn't talk too much about the Warriors. And also follow us on Twitter, NateDuncanNBA and Danny LaRue. We've both been live tweeting these games, and of course we'll be doing so throughout the playoffs as well. We'll be back tomorrow night. Talk to you all then.